Today, I'm going to continue in the series. Here comes the judge, number 8. But prior to launching into chapter 8 of the book of Daniel, just to recap a couple of items that may be of importance. I remember when I first began my trek in the Church of God and hearing a lot about prophecy. Prophecy is of interest to a lot of people. Many books have been written on it, and unfortunately many people have been wrong about their prophetic utterances. I can't help think of Hal Lindsey and his great book, The Late Great Planet Earth, and the predictions that he had, and made a lot of appearances on television proclaiming what was going to happen, and lo and behold, it didn't happen. Now, he's not the only one. There are others, and I think Mr. Van Stinson has talked about some of that. So when, in the course of my presentation on the issue of maybe refocusing our attention on the book of Daniel to an area or an arena that I think we have given short attention to, it perhaps has caused some people some concern because of two statements that I've made. And I want to talk briefly about those two statements. The first statement is, I don't know who the beast is. And the second one is, I don't care. Well, now that is attention getting, but I think it bears some explanation. When I say I don't know who the beast is, it's because I've been in the church long enough to have seen a lot of beasts come and go. Franz Josef Strauss comes to mind, since he came to Pasadena back in the old days, and he was proclaimed to be the beast of Bavaria, and he was going to be the one who was going to lead Germany on this trek as part of the United States of Europe, or some form of a European connection, a union. And lo and behold, this man was mugged in New York City, this beast of Bavaria. He got mugged. He wasn't so beastly there, even though he was packing. That is, he had a gun, but it didn't matter to the cats in New York City, you see. But, of course, today he's dead, so he can't be the beast of Bavaria. And there have been a host of others who've come along. And I got to looking at the issue of the Germanic notions surrounding the beast power, and lo and behold, I realized that the present occupant of the throne of England is of German descent. Did you all know that? In fact, Prince Philip, or the Duke of Edinburgh, is direct descendant of German. In fact, he had to renounce the throne of Greece and Denmark in 1947. Philip, who's married to Elizabeth, who is a descendant of Victoria. The old name for the House of Windsor was not Windsor. The name was Sachsen, Goldberg, und Goldblatt, or something like that, a German name. It was changed in 1917 by George V because he felt, well, we were fighting the Germans in this World War I thing, we better change the name to something more acceptable. My point is that the present occupants of the throne of England, going back to Queen Victoria, who was a cousin, first cousin of Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany. You see the problem? When you begin to say, we got it all figured out. The problem is that we don't have it all figured out. Now, if we don't have it all figured out, what then should we be concentrating upon? When I say I don't know who the beast power is, well, I have a suspicion. I have a speculation. But is that important for me in my relationship with God? And what I have extracted from the book of Daniel is that Daniel had an ongoing relationship with God that transcended the occurrences of the changing even of kingdoms. It didn't change his mind when he was in the lion's den. It didn't change his mind when Nebuchadnezzar died and a new king sat on the Babylonian throne. It didn't change his mind when the Babylonian Empire fell. And lo and behold, come the Medes and the Persians. Nothing changed his mind and his relationship with God. So maybe that's what we should be concentrating on when we try to figure out what the future holds. So I don't know. Maybe it will come from Europe, and maybe it will be some other configuration of people in the European arena. It's kind of interesting. Of course, it's not unique that brothers would fight against brothers. I mean, Cain and Abel comes to mind, and Esau and Jacob comes to mind. Absalom killing Amnon, his brother, King David's boys. I mean, so that stuff kind of happens, and it may happen again. When I say I don't care because events are going to happen whether I like them or not, or however I choose to predict them to happen. They're going to happen. The book of Daniel points that out. Also, the book of Jonah points out that even when you come with a prophecy proclaiming that if you don't repent, in 3 days this nation or this city of Nineveh is going to be destroyed, when repentance comes, God forestalls the prophecy. Oh, he does. I contend that if Belshazzar had paid attention to what Daniel told him when the handwriting was on the wall and repented, maybe his kingdom wouldn't have fallen in that night. So, I don't know. I don't care. I guess I wouldn't be going through this series if I really didn't care. I guess I wouldn't be taking a look at how one is going to survive the tribulation or the horrors or the calamities that are promised to befall this world if I really didn't care. So I thought maybe we ought to take a look at what Daniel had to see and how he had a relationship with God. So don't be troubled by the statement. It got your attention, got you talking. Of course, I've only heard positive comments about the series. Just through the back door, I guess, I've heard a few comments of people troubled or at least wondering what I meant. Maybe that'll help. But if you have further inquiry, please contact me and we can talk about it some more. So now we move to Daniel 8. Interesting. In the previous chapter, it was in the first year of Belshazzar that Daniel received a vision. We are now in the third year of Belshazzar's reign. And as I told you, from chapter 7 on to the end of the book, these are not in chronological order in the sense that it's not part of the story flow of the book of Daniel. This happened in the third year. And it says in verse 2, I saw in a vision, and this is awkwardly put, the way it's put in this chapter, this particular verse, I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was in Shushan in the palace. Shushan was in Susa. That is east of Babylon. It is north of the Persian Gulf. It is in present-day Persia, or Iran, to give you some relationship as to where he was when he saw this vision. He was in present-day, or what is similar to present-day, Iran. And Iran is a derivative of the Persian Empire. The Shah of Iran was one of the rulers who considered himself a descendant from the Persian Empire. Now, he's there in this place. He's on the river Ulay, which direction has been changed today, and it's divided actually into an upper and a lower river. It is no longer in the same tributary that it once existed when Daniel was writing this, but it gives you the location, modern Iran. He lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. And I saw the ram rushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hands. But he did according to his will and became great. Sounds interesting. No way can you figure that out without an explanation. And the explanation to verses 3 and 4 is found in verse 20. And I should say right at this point, there are three areas of this book or this chapter that we'll be dealing with. We'll be dealing with the ram, we'll be dealing with the goat, and we'll be dealing with the 2300 days. because that is the essential element of the book. Now, an interesting thing about these animals versus the animals in the previous chapter. These are all clean animals. You can eat a ram. You can eat a goat. But the other animals, the leopard and the bear and so forth, the lion, are not clean animals. That is, they are not part of the dietary permissive list that you can cull from and choose and pick according to the book of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. So these are not as fierce as the beasts mentioned in the previous chapter, but remember in the previous chapter those four beasts that were given there are world-ruling empires, but now this vision is going to be very specific about two of those world-ruling empires. The two empires covered in verse 3 and 4, the first one is the Medo-Persian Empire. Look at verse 20 for the explanation. The ram which you saw, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. Now, there were a number of kings of these kingdoms, but I guess we could say Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian would be a good starting place to begin the discussion about those two kings. Remember that Darius was the ruler upon the destruction of the Babylonian Empire, and Daniel worked for him. Then Cyrus the Persian came along, and Daniel worked for him as well. In fact, he lived through the reign of Cyrus. But Cyrus was more powerful than was the Darius the Mede. So we got this ram with two horns, similar to the two kingdoms that had combined themselves in league. So verses 3 and 4 are talking about that empire. Now, verses 5 through 8 describes the goat. But before we do, let me look at verse 4 about rushing westward, northward, and southward. If you remember where I said Susa is, or Shushan, the palace, it's in Iran. And historically, the Medo-Persian Empire had taken care of everything to the east of it. And it began to expand eastward. I think am I pointing in the right direction? Eastward? Well, you get the point. Let me be north. And then we'll say we're going east, then we're going north, and then we're going south. That's the description here because the eastern part of where Iran sits or where Susa sits has been taken care of. And that's what's described in verse 4. It wants to, it does according to its will, and it became great. But verse 5 through 8 tells us about a goat. And as I was considering, I guess he was. You know, here's Daniel seeing this vision. He's trying to, considering it. Maybe he considers like you consider. I wonder what that means. And before he can figure it out, along comes this goat. He came from the west on the face of the whole earth. When you find out who this empire is, and the name, one part of its name is very much mentioned in news today dealing with Kosovo, and south of there's a place called Macedonia. And it's important to remember that because Macedonia combined with another nation called Greece to form the next world-ruling empire called the Greco-Macedonian Empire. So those people have a long history. And if Macedonia and Greece were so bad at one time, could they be bad again? Possibly. Something to think about when you're considering trying to figure out who the beast is. Well, let's go on and read verse 5. He came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto it in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hands. This goat was a bad goat. And it turns out that the explanation given to us in verses 21 and 22 of what this means reads as follows. and the rough goat is the king of Grecia. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, the interesting thing about Daniel is that Daniel will not live to see this. And when he wrote it, it was not written close or any proximity to the time. So those who would have a problem with the book of Daniel saying, well, this was written after the fact, well, Daniel was long dead. The fact is that this is a reference to a man named Alexander the Great, around 333 B.C., to about 331 B.C. was when he was conquering at a lightning pace, coming out of the west, assuming himself into that region of the world and conquering that empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, with such speed and such force that when he got to Egypt, he sat down and wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. Alexander the Great. He was that ferocious king. Look at verse 1 again. The first king is the horn that is between his eyes that is described on the goat, that horn. Alexander the Great. But the explanation that we receive of verses 5 through 8 continues in verse 22 by saying, now, that being broken, that one horn that represented Alexander the Great, he died, if my history memory is correct, I think he was like 31. Oh, by the way, just to throw this in, he was a homosexual too. History records, or anybody who would like to consider it, that all homosexuals, you know, are girly men. Just throw that in. He was a pretty tough dude. Conquering worlds, but then in the Greek world, associated with a certain sexual act, has the appellation Greek applied to it, and that's all I'll say about that for your consideration. But there he was. Oh, I don't say that to justify homosexuality, just to throw it in. I better say that because people will be thinking, oh, I wonder what he meant by that. No, not a justification, just a realization. Well, after he dies, his kingdom is broken up into four kingdoms, verse 22. Four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation of the Greeks, but not in his power. And two of the famous kings out of this were the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, or from Seleucus was one of the generals that Alexander the Great had, and the other one was Ptolemy. Ptolemy took Egypt, and Seleucus took Syria. And they became the very prominent governors or kings of the four kingdoms that came and emerged out of the Greco-Macedonian Empire once Alexander the Great was dead. So you will notice that the explanations for verse 5 through 8 are explained in just two verses, verses 21 and 22. Now, history tells us some interesting things. It tells us, of course, that what Daniel saw in this vision did happen. He lived through a part of it with the Medo-Persian Empire, but he did not live during the Greco-Macedonian Empire, which is very astounding. But it was prophesied to happen, and it happened. Verses 9 through 14 introduce us to an individual that we come to know from history as Antiochus Epiphanes, a very interesting name. Epiphanes is a word that means, it comes out of Epiphany, which talks about the presence. Well, his name meant Antiochus, God manifest. That's what Epiphanes means, God manifest. That tells you where his head was at, what he thought of himself. But verses 9 through 14, let's read them quickly. And out of one of them came forth a little horn. Well, out of the Seleucids, or the Seleucus regime in Syria, came Antiochus Epiphanes. He came out of that. There were a number of Antiochuses. He was Antiochus the Fourth, with the appellation Epiphanes thrown onto his name, and there were descendants after him who were also Antiochuses, if I can use it that way. Well, out of this kingdom came a little horn, and this little horn should not be confused with the little horn of the book of Daniel, 7th chapter. It is similar in some sense, but is not the same reference. Which waxing exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Pleasant land is used in Daniel different times to refer to Jerusalem or Palestine. That was always considered the pleasant or glorious land. And this king, this little horn, waxed great even to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. This is a direct reference to what Antiochus Epiphanes did when he marched into Jerusalem and caused great destruction. He caused the temple worship to cease in 167 BC, stopped. And from this period of time of history, we get the Maccabees. Handel wrote an oratorio called Judas Maccabeus, where he talks about the struggles of the Maccabean people to throw off the shackles of this Greco-Macedonian empire that had so stifled them in their worship. And the temple was desecrated by bringing in a statue of Zeus, who was a Greek mythological god. He brought it in. He set up an altar, and some say he even sacrificed a pig on the altar in the presence of the people of God, which when we think about the stars and the hosts being thrown to the ground, you begin to see the metaphor that maybe Daniel is using as he seeks to describe this vision he sees. Antiochus in verse 11, yet he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. And it cast down to the truth, down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. And then I heard one saint speaking to another saint and saying, that certain saint which spoke, how long shall it be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, or the abomination of desolation is the term that we have often associated with it, which does show up later in the book of Daniel, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot. Well, how long? As I said, it ceased in 167 B.C., and it began again in 164 B.C., which, if you do your math of the 2300 days that we will be introduced to here in verse 14, he said unto me, until 200 and 300 days. My margin tells me that days should have been translated evening and morning. And when you do the division, you divide 2300 by 2, you come to 1150 days. That is, a morning and an evening sacrifice was the standard in the Jewish worship. So instead of really 2300 days, it was 1150 days, which is a little more than 3 years. Hence, historically, it can be established that there is some historical disagreement about it, but basically 167 B.C. was when Antiochus came through and did his thing, and the sacrifices ceased, and then in 164, the temple was cleansed. Why? Because the Maccabees, and if you want to read some of the apocryphal books, those books that are inserted between the Old and New Testament and the Catholic Bible and other sources, you can read 1 Maccabeus, which gives you a historical perspective of that period of time. And Judas was just one of many of the Maccabees' brothers who were serious fighters to find liberation. It's celebrated in a festival called, is it Purim? Help me out if anybody remembers. There is a Jewish festival that they commemorate each year. That's not part of the holiday cycle, but it is a commemoration of the Maccabee period of time, of that liberation from the domination of the Greeks. If you remember it, you can tell me before the sermon over, and we'll put it out on the airwaves, and maybe I'll remember it myself. I should have written it down. Well, the explanation for verses 9 through 14, it's found in verses 23 through 25. Here's what we find. The interesting thing is we find that it is for the latter time of their kingdom. Now, a word about that. There are three verses that talk about the latter time in this chapter. And so many associate the events of this chapter with happening at the latter time. But historically, Antiochus Epiphanes did exist. He did cause the sacrifice to cease in Jerusalem. He did desecrate the temple. But as in prophecy, there are types and antitypes. There are formers and ladders. There are also foreshadowing of the future. So as bad as Antiochus Epiphanes was in his day to do what he did, there is the assertion in the explanation that it's going to happen like that again. But there is something missing at the moment. There is no temple. There is no priesthood actively having evening and morning sacrifices. So what has to happen for this to be totally fulfilled in the end time is that a temple must, or some form of temple worship, some form of sacrifice must go on. Now, I would say that when you see that happening in Jerusalem, that is something to pay attention to. But running over the landscape at every whiff and puff of innuendo and rumor. Now, you can see it on CNN, and you can see it on Fox. It won't be a mystery when it happens, because it will be news. It is not happening now. But when it happens, then you can begin to say, oh, now maybe I should get my stuff together. Maybe now I need to repent. Maybe now there's just a little time left, but it's not happening at the moment, and so some people take license about it. But all I'm saying at this point is that here's the explanation. In the latter time of their kingdom, the Greco-Macedonian kingdom, when the transgressors are come to full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. That's Antiochus Epiphanes. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. I find that interesting. Through the Bible, we find God closing off the mind of the Pharaoh, hardening his heart is the expression. God doing it. We find in a passage in 1 Chronicles where Satan moves into David's mind to cause him to number Israel. So my question is, when this phrase comes up, not by his own power, what does it mean? Could it be that Antiochus Epiphanes is under Satan's control? Or did God set him to do the things that he's going to do? Let's take a look in Revelation 17 at a phrase, and it does break into a thought about Babylon and about the things that the beast will do against the great whore described in this chapter. But let's look at a verse, Revelation 17 and verse 17. It is taken out of that context, but maybe it gives us a glimpse as to what this phrase, but not by his own power, referring to Antiochus Epiphanes, and what it means. Verse 17 says, "For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled." Oh, that's an interesting little principle there, that God will use anybody, any situation, any circumstance, including Satan himself, to challenge a man like Job. "Have you considered my servant Job?" says the description in the first chapter of Job. And Satan says, "Well, yeah, he doesn't worship you for nothing." And along comes this dialogue where God, to test Job, uses Satan. So when we are trying to find out who's doing what and who's zooming whom and all those kinds of things, let us consider that Antiochus Epiphanes, or his later representation, will be under the domination of the one who controls everything, even if he has to utilize Satan to accomplish his will. His will be accomplished. It goes on to say, "And he shall destroy wonderfully." That's a misleading term, but it shall be like astoundingly is the term, and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people, the Jews, in Palestine. And through his policies also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hands. In other words, there's going to be an economic boom. And many allege that because of the European euro and all of that, that somehow, maybe as more intrusion occurs into the Middle East and economic development and prosperity occurs, that will be a means by which craft increases and prosperity increases and all those kinds of things. He shall magnify himself in his heart. I told you what Epiphanes means. God manifest. I mean, can you imagine a guy naming himself that? It's like there are a couple of... There's a basketball player, and I can't remember who he plays for now, a college player whose name is G-O-D. His folks named him that. I think I would change it, but he probably is having fun with it, you know. His first name is G-O-D. There are a lot of Jesuses around, but I won't comment about that. That's just a regular name, Jesus or... Yahshua or Joshua, those kinds of names, that's a little different, but to have one have as part of your name, God manifest, is to tell you where your head is at. And so Antiochus Epiphanes was a difficult dude, as they say. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many, by prosperity and having the control of economy. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Antiochus Epiphanes died unfulfilling a lot of things. He was a lesser of the Antiochuses, really. He had been up in Rome for a while and was kind of lounging around and decided, as some people will do, to make a name for himself and to be hard and tough. And that's why he moved out into this region and began to do the things he did. But it was prophesied, and Daniel saw it. Now, you've got to ask yourself this question: what impact did these things have on Daniel as he saw them? He lived through certain ones, the handwriting on the wall. He lived through the reality of the cessation of the Babylonian Empire. Did he worry and sweat and wonder, am I going to survive? What's going to happen to me? Lo and behold, Darius liked him. The Mede, and brought him into his realm and gave him a lofty office. Well, what's going to happen after Darius? What's going to happen to me with these evil people? Cyrus liked him and gave him and continued his presence and his office. So as he's watching these things unfold, what is Daniel's perspective? What is his attitude? Is he running for the hills? Is he inciting people to buy frozen foods and freeze-dried foods and storing up bottled water? Is he getting people to the point of saying, you know, maybe we will be able to buy some 747s or DC-10s. That's the one, DC-10s that was crashing a lot. We'll get those and we'll fly off to a place of safety. Daniel was protected in the lion's den. The Hebrew boys were protected in the fiery furnace. That's what we get out of this, because in the fulfillment and the marching of prophecy, where is your protection? Whom do you rely upon? In whom do you trust? Daniel shows us clearly that even though perplexed by the things he saw, as he said up in verse 17, so he came near. This is where Gabriel had been told to tell him what this is all. Well, let's go back to verse 15 very quickly. It came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. I suggest that it was Jesus Christ, or the one who became Jesus Christ, for he, and it could have been an angel. It doesn't have to be Christ, but someone in authority who could tell Gabriel, in verse 16, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. Now, who is in authority over Gabriel? Either God the Father or God the Son. because Gabriel is an archangel. Does it make sense? I hope that we would consider that, that it was just not simply a man standing around. This is a vision. This is a situation where Daniel is being told some things. So the explanation continues down through this verse 25. Then verse 26 says this, "And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore, shut you up the vision, for it shall be for many days. Daniel did not live to see it. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days afterwards. I rose up and did the king's business." Ooh, I love that. Oh, I love that verse. Because there are people who figure, we can't go on. We gotta find some way out. Where can we go? Let's go to Petra. Let's go there because that seems to be a good hiding place. Or let's go stand on a high mountain someplace. There have been movements and groups of people, including the group waiting on this comet to come, remember? And they committed suicide out there in California, I believe it was. There have been people who have sold everything they had to go to a place and wait for the return of Jesus Christ. But I like what Daniel does. He sees this, and he gets up, and he goes about the king's business. He lives his life. He goes about to wait because it is for the end. He says, "I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it." Now, I have some grasp of prophecy from the point of view of that which has already been fulfilled. I'm amazed at the things that I read in the book of Daniel that came true before it happened. It is astounding to me that you can read in the book of Isaiah, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a child, a son." That's amazing. It happened 600 years after he said it. And the specificity of other prophecies truly amaze me. But when it comes to me as an individual trying to figure it all out, I have been wrong more times than right. Why? Because, like Daniel, understanding was not present, even though Daniel was told certain things that he did not live to see, and it was hard for him to comprehend that there would be a goat like Alexander the Great, and that there would be four kings, and that kingdom would be divided, and that they would have turmoil within it, and that Antiochus Epiphanes, unnamed, would come along. It was hard for him to comprehend it. So he gets this instruction to shut up the book. Shut up the chapter, rather, and then in chapter 12, he also is told to shut up the book, for it's to the end of time. Many feel that we're close to the end of the age, when Jesus Christ is going to return, and God is going to set his hand to exert his wrath, and the day of the Lord, and all those things are supposed to happen. What do I learn from this chapter alone that can relate to us today? Get up each day and go about the king's business. In our case, it's not Cyrus, it's not Darius, it's not Belshazzar, but it's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, to get up and go about his business, because it is his business. He will take care of the situation, and most importantly, he will take care of you.